I am Emily Katsianis. I am interviewing
Cynthia Haynes.
Yeah. It's June 2nd. Yep. At 1:56. So, would you tell me about when you first joined RSA?
I can't actually remember if I joined at the time, but it was in grad school because the first conference, I was at University of Texas at Arlington. So, when the first conference was held, the first three conferences, actually, and I was one of the grad students helping work the registration table and going to the airport, picking up the keynote speakers. Those are my early memories, of RSA. I'm sure I joined, but I don't remember. So, I guess I could say that's when I first joined, because I was heavily involved with those conferences. And Charles Kneiper was one of my professors. I know Michael Feehan, who's probably talked to you already about Charles, maybe others. So that's, I guess, back as far as 84 or 5 or 6 or whenever that first conference was. Ever since second grade. I started there at 84 as a grad student, but I think maybe the first conference was 86. I think they are a bit on even years.
The levels for me are okay.
There were three. The first three were at Arlington. And then I heard in the first 25-year panel the other day, there was Rich Enos might have been explaining that then the fourth one was in the early 90s, like maybe 92. So maybe it was 84, 86, 88, or 86, 88, 90, something like that, because I was there between 84 and 94, and we had three conferences. And Jim Berlin was one of the keynote speakers, and that might have been the second one. But yeah.
How would you describe the organization experience in those early years, and maybe how it's changed?
It's certainly grown. I haven't been actually to RSA in 10 years, because to the conference, because my husband and I, he's Norwegian, and we have
and that was perfect. That
home in Norway, and in May is when the only time we can go. So for the last 10 years or so, we usually go to Norway in May, but this year I'm winning, I won the 2017 Book Award, so I'm coming to accept the Book Award, and then I gave a paper, but, so 10 years ago, I went to the one in Seattle, I think it was 10 years ago, and prior to that, it was, again, for the last 20 years or so, we've been in Norway. But I was at those first three.
It was as a graduate student.
And my experience with the organization is that it's been more of my academic home than Four Cs or the Beauties of Writing, even though I've been very active in those. Gone to Four Cs every year for, except for the last 2 or 3 years, for many, many years. But that's, this is now, this conference feels as big as Four Cs, but it feels very different because it's,
California.
It's more focused on rhetoric, of course. I can do more of my thing, which is rhetorical theory and criticism and performative delivery of my talks, and feel at home that I have an audience. I guess it's important that that audience in this organization feels like more of my audience. I mean, I am a writing program director, but so Four Cs in that sense would be, for that part of what I do. I don't publish, I'm not a scholar though, in composition studies or WPA administration or any of that. That's just my day job. Really? I mean, A long one. I've been doing that for 24 years. But rhetoric is my love, you know, and that's what I do. So this conference has always been an academic conference, really. I just don't get to come as often as I'd like. I wish it was every year. I mean, could I put in a plug to the powers that be, you know, to please? I've never been to one of the summer institutes, but I would like to get involved in those and maybe teach one of the seminars or team teach it or whatever, however they're done. But my students have gone, though, and they've always benefited from them and come back with amazing experiences. So the summer institutes have been very important to many of the students that are in our at Clemson, the Rhetoric, Communication, Information Design PhD program. And when I was before at Clemson, I was in another graduate humanities program, but we didn't have a concentration in rhetoric. In fact, I was the only rhetoric faculty member at University of Texas at Dallas because it was a humanities program with no departments. So I answered to the dean, and we had tracks of literary studies and historical studies and aesthetic studies, which had the creative writers. But I ran the first year rhetoric program and then taught graduate courses in rhetoric. And many of those students went on to go into the field of rhetoric rather than literary studies. But all that to say is that the WPA part and 4Cs and the distinction between how our field bifurcates itself in a way between composition and rhetoric. In fact, I wrote a piece one time for the Enculturation Journal, did a little. It did an issue how many years ago on discuss, with those of us who were invited to contribute were to discuss the slash between composition and rhetoric, or the, you know. So mine is actually on the slash.
If not, why not?
It was more on the rhetoric side. Anyway, I'm kind of rambling on that part now.
You're totally good. Congrats on the book award.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
I know you mentioned rhetoric is kind of your love.
Yeah.
Aside from like that specific focus, what else do you think makes RSA such a nice like academic home? Which is good phrasing, by the way. I really like that.
At that time was not really good.
Well,
rhetoric per se explicitly.
For one thing, it was small, and that felt intimate, which doesn't mean that the fact that it's grown is bad. I enjoy that. I've met a lot of really interesting people and seen some fascinating research presented, and in fact, it has been many years since I have gone back-to-back panels 3 days in a row. And I can't be here tomorrow, but many years, because I just don't have the stamina for it, but I could not here. First of all, I have many students here. I have probably 10 PhD students presenting, and so I've been in and out, and former students who are out and tenured, you know, so I've been, but I have been to some panels of people that don't know, but the intimacy of it, and I think Rich Enos explained it the other night in this first 25 years panel, that Rhetoric Society of America was called a society for a reason, because it was a community of people and not an association or an organization or whatever. And that resonated with me because it has been. And because it was so small, and I mean really small, when it first started in terms of the conferences, prior to 84, and I learned a lot from that panel because Janice Lauer and Mark Halloran and Kathleen Welch were all, and Victor were all explaining, and Rich were all explaining the early years in the 60s and 70s, which was fascinating. But they didn't organize a conference until, you know, the mid-80s, and Charles Clapper did that. And I want to talk a little bit more about Charles whenever you're ready, but but yeah, that's one of the reasons was because in the beginning it was so intimate, and these stars in rhetoric, the people I was studying and actually studying with, were I was very fortunate, you know, to have those people in the program I was in.
Yeah, I don't
were so down to earth. I mean, I remember Jim Berland, that year he was keynote, and I think we took him out to a Mexican restaurant one night, and he loved it. And he, you know, lived up in Purdue and West Lafayette, and I sent him, I mailed him tacos. I mean, there are all the stuff to make tacos. I'll put it that way. I mailed him the and the guacamole. I mailed him stuff to make everything you needed because this was in Texas. I'm a Texan. He loved the Mexican food. So that was kind of a little cute anecdote that Berlin was like that, you know. And because Victor and was my chair, and Victor and Jim were extremely close. There was a camaraderie between Jim's students and Victor's students, so, and there still is. The academic children and grandchildren of those two men, and the women also, Susan Jarrett, Jan Swearingen. Jan was at UT Arlington, and Susan was at that conference, and Kathleen Welch was at that conference, and Winifred Horner from TCU, and those folks from the TCU crowd, which was just next to Fort Worth and Arlington are together. So in the beginning, it was just this very intimate group of graduate students of these people and the scholars and rhetoricians.
So then one of the key
that just formed a real cohesive grounding and foundation, or I guess, you know, I'll put it that way. Very formative for me.
That sounds like a great way to sort of be introduced into a field, to have those like colleagues and,
yeah,
and relationships.
Right.
Did he ever make the tacos? Did he tell you?
Yeah, he did. And they made it there all intact. I don't even remember what all I said, but he reminded me some years later, before he died, that I had done that, and I had totally forgotten. So I've kept that memory now because I don't know. It was a whim, I guess. I mailed him the taco stuff. Jim was, and I remember when we learned he died, Victor was teaching, and his wife went to tell him to get him out of class because she knew it was going to be devastating, and that was very hard. By then, I was had already taken my first job at UT Dallas, but so I had graduated, but just had, it was, I think, 93, 94, 95, it was around then, I can't remember, but yeah.
So when you look
certainly
back,
lost a very important person.
Yes, very much. And I was went to Purdue to give a talk a couple years, 3, 4, 5 years ago, and Thomas Rickert and Jenny Bay took me into the Berlin archives. I mean, they've got a room with all his papers, and I was just like, oh my gosh, this is amazing. And it meant a lot to me because this is what I did for Charles Knapper. When Charles died, and I'll tell you a little bit about that.
Absolutely, I'd love to hear that.
When Charles died, and this was in the late 80s, when AIDS was not something any, or even once, you know, sexual preference was not, and Charles was not. We knew, but many people didn't know at all about his private life or anything. And when he got sick, it happened fast. He went down very fast. So, okay. So he passed away. It was very devastating. Well, if you can believe this or not, there were people who didn't, his own family did not want his things. There were people that didn't want to touch his things, if you can believe that, because he passed away of AIDS and AIDS complications. And I was a graduate student and director of the Writing Center at the same time. I had the last 4 years I was working on my, I'd finished my coursework, but I was working on my dissertation. And I was director of the Writing Center, and we had our Writing Center was on in a former department, so we had not just one room, we had a floor, and it had multiple offices, and those were our two-day rooms, and then I had a couple of rooms with computers in them. So Charles's books in his office, and I said, I want to make a Charles Knapper Memorial Library. So I did. And I cleaned his office out. I saved his papers, organized them. I moved the books. He was on the second floor. I moved him up to the fifth floor where the Writing Center was. I took one of those tutoring rooms. It was small, but it was enough. About the size of his office, actually, because it was a faculty office originally. So I set up the Charles Knapper Memorial Library, and it was for the grad students. Now, it was in the undergraduate, the Writing Center was for everybody, but it's mostly an undergraduate Writing Center. And so, but I wanted to make it comfy, so I brought some of my own stuff from home. I brought a lamp and a table and had a reading area. And the books, and I shelved them, categorized them. I had a stamp made that went in every book, the Charles Knapper Memorial Library. And it was for graduate students because this was his library of text and back issues of journals and tons of back then, because we all had Xerox copy things, out of stuff, and I still have some of that. And I kept his dissertation. His family, like I said, didn't want anything. I kept his copy of his bound copy of his dissertation, which I still have. I didn't leave it, and I don't know why, but I just kept it. And I have some of his syllabi. I just kept a few of those. And sadly, many years ago, this was back in 1990.
Tax off the stage. And so I started with that.
89, 90, something like that, that I was doing this.
Kind of critique.
Yeah.
And saying that,
after I left UT Arlington, they moved the library to the actual campus library. And
so that was a sort of
then they dispersed the books, and I don't know what happened to them. And then and they just took it down.
I was one of the four,
and we have no idea
RSA,
where any of the books went. They might have gone into
really
the library.
The main sponsor,
I don't. I just don't know. Much less the papers. I have no idea.
That's a really moving tribute that you did. I'm so sad to hear that. That's sort of the epilogue to it.
Yeah. Yeah. But it meant a lot to me to do that for him and for us, and for our grad students, and
places and time.
And it was well utilized. There were a lot of times where people just could come up there and be in a quiet place and sit. And I interviewed Victor for Harper's magazine. We sat in there, and so it was kind of a place where it just felt good to be in there. And I took a picture of Charles's door before I took everything down, because we all have, as faculty members, what I call door art. I can even send that to you if you want. I don't know what you're going to do with these, but
you know what? Yeah, we'll get an email that you can send it to, because that would be really cool.
Yeah, it's just a picture of his door before I took all the stuff off of it down. There were just, put quotes of things on there, pictures. I don't remember what all was on it. And so, yeah, that's one of the main things I wanted to share, because he was very... The other thing I wanted to talk about with him was that, in terms of RSA,
Mike Leff was,
as a rhetoric student, grad student, I was always working on my writing and trying to improve my writing. Charles said, you can study what we are assigning you to read as pieces of writing. Wow. stylistically, I was mind-blowing. I was all these things. I had stacks of it. Because I had issues with...
I didn't know the key, the repertoire of a variety of verbs used, and there's quotes, you know, just that kind of thing, you know, when you're writing your dissertation or your prospectus or whatever. So what I did is I took an article of Charles's. It was like a 40-page article, and I don't remember which one. And I wrote down all the ways that he structured folding a quote into a sentence, all of the verbs that he used to introduce quotes. You know, like, according to Nietzsche, in Nietzsche's estimation, Nietzsche contends for this or that. And then I made this list. And it was amazing. He never repeated a verb in a 40-page article as he introduced quotes. So that told me, first of all, that wasn't accidental, that he had maybe written his work and then gone back and in his revision process. I don't know that was how he did it, but that's the only way I can think of it. If it were me, you know, I would do that. But that was an amazing thing that he taught me, and I teach my graduate students that now, you know, something like that. You know, anything that you want to do. In fact, I just finished teaching a seminar on academic writing, or, you know, looking at exemplary writers, and we would talk, we'd split the seminar 3 hours up into talking about the content, and then we'd talk about sentences, and we would actually look at sentences, and how did they do that? How are introductions? How did the structure of the thing? You know, it was from Charles. That looking at writing and thinking about it in that way.
Such an amazing lesson, and I like the way that you are sort of passing it on to more students.
Well, it was the way I learned. I mean, one of the ways. I had other teachers that were also like Victor and Lou Anne Frank and others, and Jan Swingen. But, and speakers that came to the conferences like Susan Jarrett and Kathleen Welch and Winifred Horner and a lot of strong women. I'll mention that too. There were feminism, feminist theory in the mid to late 80s was happening in our field. And sophistic historiography and, you know, all of that.
And so I was no help at all.
Dan formed a group called the Femme Critters. Yeah, it was kind of a little reading group, and we met in people's homes, you know, in different places. But the women in RSA were extremely influential on me. And I traveled to New Mexico a lot, and Jan was teaching it in the summers at the Ghost Ranch, doing seminars on writing and stuff. And we had we met up one time with my first husband and her, and we went down to this monastery. And but anyway, so Jan's gone now. Wynn's gone, and it was really good to see Kathleen Welch. And, but yeah. Well, the women were, because of what was happening at that same time, that confluence was all happening at RSA.
When theory hit in the 70s,
not at Four Seas. It was an RSA.
It sounds like the conference sort of was maybe responding to discussions instead of like sticking to the party line almost.
Definitely. I mean, there were. There was a focus, I'll put it this way, on, I remember, my memory's kind of hazy about specific, you know, programs or talks, but there were, there was a lot on history of rhetoric, and because out of that came some of those collections that Victor edited, the one, and the feminist historiography of rhetoric, and things like that. So the history of rhetoric might have been maybe one of the first foci of RSA as they started to try to open it up or sort of define it, put boundaries around it. But then the women were bringing in Sappho and Sor Juana, Jan.
was a
so there were other non-rhetorician women that were being introduced into the canon, so to speak. The canon was being questioned, and there was so all of that was extremely formative for me that was happening in those conferences. And then, of course, the back and forth debates with Berlin's work and Lester Fegley and Victor and the cultural leftist Marxist criticism that was also going on, and Berlin's work on composition theory and so forth. But that was being discussed in the RSA as well.
That seems like sort of a theme in what you've been telling me of this idea of things like being conversations is something that it started.
And we had a lot of conversations outside of the panels. There were, you know, receptions, there were gatherings, and because it was a small group. And because of that, we could have these. I have pictures of Jim and Victor, you know, with little plastic glasses of wine in their hand at somebody's house. You know, that's what happened. We didn't have any money. So we held this first one at this yucky. There was one of them. One of the three held at this yucky hotel in Arlington, over by Six Flags over Texas, and I was like, oh my god, this is terrible. I was in the hotel business actually I first went to grad school, and I worked for a Four Seasons hotel, which was really nice. And because the budget was very low for this, and UT Arlington, I guess, was going in on some of it, and maybe we charged a little bit for. I don't know. I don't remember. So there were one of them was held at this really bad hotel over, you know, and the food was horrible, and it didn't matter. We were all just having a good time, and the grad students were young enough that, you know, that was cool. We were just happy to be in the same room. And I was talking to Michelle Baloff and Diane Davis the other day, and we were reminiscing about sitting at that table, the registration table. There's some pictures of us also sitting there having these deep conversations. I don't know who took the pictures. But we had a Gorgias Society for the grad students. That was our grad student organization. And I was president of it for several years, and so was Diane and Michelle and others probably know. And we were, you know, helping with behind the scenes of the organization. We weren't exploited or drafted into doing this for them. This was, we wanted to, you know. We even, in 92, put on our own conference on critical theory, and Gayatri Spivak was our keynote speaker, and we had, you know, it was, but we learned from having done the RSA conference, you see. This weekend, that also was teaching us how to hold a conference, just in terms of pragmatics and protocols. And how do you be a liaison with the speakers? And, organization and coordination, and that is not a. That is a skill set that grad students, now it's probably taken for granted that you have some kind of service prior to getting out of grad school that you have on your CV of either coordinating or organizing or serving, you know, in some capacity for a conference. You know, it's not it's an important thing for them to know. But we wanted to. We weren't
thought of it
forced to do any of that. Just want to make that point.
Yeah, and I think you're right that that sort of learning the field, but then also, like you said, learning how to put on a conference, that is not an easy thing to do.
No, it's not. I would never want to do it again. I did one this year. It was a very small one. It was just a one-day thing, but it was, you know, there's a lot of work involved. Actually, I was the faculty sponsor, and the two grad students that did the work. But yeah, so that was an important sort of behind the scenes part of it. That and but you know, these the faculty that came, the scholars that came, were they treated us as equals. We were, like I said, Windhorner students at TCU and Lester Fagley students at UT Austin and all the Arlington School people and the Purdue people. We were, we all knew each other. And now, Lynn Worsham's students, I mean, I was just like,
I guess that's what I've been part of, but I didn't quite.
The way it has all, the academic children and grandchildren, as I mentioned before, it really, you can see the influence in RSA among all those people.
I'm trying to think of what, I think it's the writing studies. Family tree, have you seen that?
No.
It's a project someone's doing where you can put in your
really
like dissertation advisor and your title, and then they're making connections between.
It's like a genealogy.
Yeah, it is.
That is a cool. That's perfect.
Yeah, it's exactly what you're describing.
Well, I had not met Kyle Jensen before, for example, and I got to hear his talk yesterday, and one of my students, I'm chairing Clemson, she had Kyle in a class at University of North Texas, and then she ends up in RCID in the first second year. She's going to add him as a fifth reader on our committee, so we go to hear him, and he's asked me to contribute something to a collection, and I needed to meet him. So we were sitting there before he starts talking, and I said, and then she was telling me about this book that's coming out on Burke's War of Words that he and Jack Seltzer found. I said, so was Jack his chair? She goes, no, Lynn Worsham was his chair. I went, that tells me all I need to know. I mean, that's all you have to say.
Yeah.
Is, you know, you mentioned Eileen Chell, which is one of Lynn's students, or, and I know this goes for Cheryl Glenn and everybody else in the field, and Andrea Lunsford, and Cheryl was Andrea's. So everybody has this lineage, and that project sounds, I need to get some plugged into that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
I'll have to double check on that name before you leave, so I'm not sending you down a Google hole. So if we're thinking about RSA, what do you foresee in RSA's future? Or what would you like to see?
Well, I'd like to see a yearly conference. Just because it's hard to wait every 2 years, you know? Although, I guess, I've not ever been to the May Summer Institute. And then there's the other institutes that they have. But so last year, for example, I'm in Norway when they announced my book award. And I'm like, if I had known, I would have gone. But anyway, yeah, I would like to see more frequent gatherings. I know that's not easy, and it's hard work on whoever is doing it. Michelle Baloff, who's the next president, or is already the next president, I'm not sure. I guess Greg Clark's the outgoing president. Anyway.
I'm not sure when
Michelle, Michelle was, and Diane and I were having this drink the other day, and Michelle looked at both of us and went, you need to help me come up with a theme for the Portland conference in 2 years. And she said, I think we're going to do the Arlington School. We're just going to do all theory. We're just going to blow this thing up. So, now, that can be on the QT, even though I know I'm on camera. This is on the record. Okay, but I don't know. I'm hopefully going to get to help come up with a theme, and that was fun, and maybe help plan. I don't know if she needs me. I'm there. So it's the reins are being handed down to the next generation of scholars, and I think we just want to preserve that rich history and that intimacy, and find a way for the growth to not affect the quality of interactions and collaborations. And I have been to some of the most amazing couple of panels, cultural rhetorics and posthumanism panels, just sort of mind-blowing, because they kind of got into a brouhaha recently, and then came together to start a conversation on the intersections. And then I went to a rhetoric and religion panel today. So many different. And another panel that had some speech communication rhetoric people in it. And so that's our strength.
Well, thank you so much.
The diversity of rhetorical work that goes on. But how can we sort of maintain the history and continue to grow? That's going to be a challenge for those in charge.
Yeah, I was reading something the other day that was talking about rhetoric being interdisciplinary,
mm-hmm.
kind of all the time, and that seems to be something that you also reflected about both then and now.
I talk about it as a meta-discipline, and it sort of ticks off some of my colleagues, because to me, rhetoric informs every discipline. So I put it as the biggest umbrella possible. It's the meta-discipline under which everything sits. Because as philosophy and rhetoric, you know, have tangled for thousands of years, it's, you know, the two huge traditions that have been in conflict. But among other disciplines, it does inform, because it's part and parcel of that language. It's the use of language in analyzing. It's so many different things, and it isn't a convenience to try to, you know, latch on to that in order to sort of finagle your way into every discipline. That's not its purpose. It just is. It's just, if it's language, you're being rhetorical. I don't care if you're a scientist. I don't care if you're a philosopher. I don't care if you're a mathematician. You're coding, you're writing code, you're programming, you're writing arguments.
I keep seeing something out of the corner of my eye,
yeah.
And so I have to watch for Christian.
I tell my students that rhetoric and philosophy are, they have sibling rivalry.
Yes, that's
how
they
work.
That's a good way to put it.
I think that's true, that idea of it being that we're rhetors.
Yeah.
And then sort of have hope. How do we do that? I'm just making sure that we hit all the questions we needed to. Are there other maybe like prominent memories throughout the years that you want to share, or things that you think are important to preserve in this history?
Persuasion and politics. And so I had to fight to just get.
I'm pretty sure I've covered them all, as many as I can remember. I've actually remembered more than I thought I was. I mean, as I started talking, and that's what rhetoric does, right?
Yeah.
You never know what you think until you see what you've written or you start talking. So it's helped to sort of, one thing led to another, and I remembered more than I remembered. Especially the part about the women. I didn't realize I wanted to get that part in. Start thinking about all the women that were present and very strong, and it was important to the men.
Mm-hmm.
I think Kathleen Welch said something about this in that first 25 year panel, that she thanked all the male feminists in our field for having been formative in helping equalize, you know, the playing field for women rhetoricians, and that is important. And I feel like, maybe with a few exceptions, most all of the men that I remember of those scholars were male, what I would call women-identified men, and they. And I don't know who put the programs together. I don't remember that. You know, I'm sure it was Charles and for the 3 years I was involved, and maybe there was a committee of other faculty people. I don't know. But because of those women who were there, and a big part of it, and because of the women graduate students and people like Lynn Worsham and others, that
we don't want to do this anymore. You know, my daughters,
we see that now. We see the result of that. And Kathleen spoke to that.
I think it's also an important point. I'm glad you pointed that out. And I think that they were there and they were foundational, and they've always been presented as such.
Right, right.
That's really.
Yeah. Susan Miller. I mean, women that are coming to my mind that aren't here with us anymore. So.
But the way that, that yeah. we were able
That's
to
wonderful.
Negotiate that was
well, thank
that
you so much.
You're welcome. Thanks for doing this. This is a great project.